Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration. Timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration.
Paul and I are sitting in the Minster Church in Cornwall, England, with Paul Broadhurst. He's written The Dance of the Dragon, an Odyssey into Earth Energies and Ancient Religion, and he's been pointing out some of the characteristics of a sacred site, what the ancients looked for in positioning their temples, later churches, and what all of the ancient religions had in common in recognition of these earth energies is the basis of the old religions. Paul, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laura. Great pleasure.
Your book is a masterpiece, I want to say. And you've been pointing out that even the trees around this church are imbued with this energy, and you can see it in their formation. So everything here is alive with this type of energy. The ancients knew this.
I think you're absolutely right. I think everywhere is alive. I think the entire earth is alive. And it's one of the things that the ancient people knew. When you come to a place such as this beautiful old church in a wooded glade in Cornwall, one immediately becomes aware of a certain quality of energy that seems to be coming from the land. And it affects different people in different ways. Some people will get the hairs on the back of their necks rise. As other people feel trickles of energy coming up and down the spine. Dowsers can actually douse this energy and delineate it in the landscape. And from a lot of the work that we've been involved in over the last sort of 15 years or so, we found that this energy is actually quite specific. There are currents of energy which flow through the earth, and this energy becomes particularly concentrated at what we call sacred sites, which these days often have churches on them. But of course, let's not forget that those churches were built on sites which were important in pre-Christian times and probably go right back to the very dawn of humanity, because I think certainly in previous times, people were much more sensitive and aware to this energy than we are today. We spend all our lives driving around in little tin boxes, walking around on concrete. So we've become desensitized to a great degree about a lot of this energy. I think also people miss this connection with the earth that they once had. And actually, people are very, very hungry now, at this stage of our evolution, to have a reconnection with that spirit of the earth.
So many of the symbols, the green man, the dragon you've been pointing out, are, if you know how to decode them, symbols of this energy. You see them a lot on the churches around here.
You do, and it's very, very interesting. You can go into cathedrals and churches all over Europe and find images of the green man, which is this human face with foliage sprouting out of the mouth usually. And it's a bit of an enigma. People often say, well, it's a hangover from the old pre-Christian religion and the old god of the woods. But I think there's a much, much deeper story to this, because a lot of this information is encoded by the medieval architects in the way they built their buildings. For instance, you go into a cathedral, you will find that most of the green men are in the roof bosses, which are the stones right at the very top of the church. Now, they're called bosses. You know, we know what the word boss means because it's gone into sort of modern language. But the boss is the critical point. And if you take the boss out, the entire church falls down. So these medieval masons were actually making this profound statement that the reason the church is there is because of the green man, which is the energy within the earth. It's the fertile, inspirational energy within the earth, which we all respond to.
And the dragon being that feminine aspect of that same energy, I'm assuming. And
yeah, I mean, the dragon, again, we have to sort of almost rewrite history in our minds, because the dragon was demonized by the Christian church And they equated it with the devil.
They were a bit patriarchal, suspicious of women, though, weren't they?
Well, they were indeed, sure, and they were into systems of control. So they had to demonize the dragon because actually people worship the dragon energy in the earth. Dragons and serpents are interchangeable in this respect, but they have always symbolized this fertile energy within the earth, and all the old legends speak of this too. And so when you put the green man and the dragon together, you've got a sort of a polarity here of the male energy and the female energies which operate within the earth. And in that polarity is creation, because you cannot have creation without the male and the female, the yin and the yang, the solar and the lunar. And this is just a fact of existence.
In China, the dragon never was demonized, and it is a symbol of joy and life and all of that. So we can only look to the old Chinese meaning to see what the ancients here must have held.
Indeed, absolutely. And in fact, it's another curious enigma that even in medieval times, the dragon wasn't demonized entirely. Britain and many other countries are absolutely full of dragon legends. And I could take you to dozens of cathedrals and churches where you will see the most magnificent dragons crawling all over the place. Now, if the dragon was a symbol of Satan, as is the received wisdom from the church, what are all these images doing in the churches and cathedrals, I would ask you? It's not true, actually. This is a later medieval interpretation of what was actually going on. The dragon is a sacred symbol.
What was seminal about your work? You and Hamish Miller were dowsing these Michael lines and the Mary lines and finding that so many sacred sites were just lined up right along these straight tracks, these lines. Tell us about your work in sussing this all out.
Well, it started off for us really many years ago when we became aware of a curious phenomenon, curious landscape phenomenon, which is known in Britain as the St. Michael line, which is a dead straight alignment of sacred sites, which stretches from the very tip of Cornwall all the way across southern Britain to the east coast. The curious thing about this line is that it goes through all the major sanctuaries and prehistoric centres of antiquity, such as Avebury, which is the greatest megalithic complex in Europe. It runs right down the centre of Glastonbury Tor through the St. Michael's Tower. It also runs through many, many other churches dedicated to St. Michael. And probably one of the most interesting aspects of this line is its cosmological dimension, because it's not an accidental thing on the landscape. It was obviously laid down and recognized many, many thousands of years ago. The line itself is created by the position that the sun rises over the horizon on May Day morning. In the ancient world, May Day morning, or Beltane, was a very, very significant part of the year, very important time when the dragon energy stirred in the earth again, and the whole fertility cycle of the earth started to come back. To the ancients, Beltane was the first day of summer. So again, we're talking about this strange mythological overlay of St. Michael slaying the dragon. St. Michael is a solar god. He's a great Christian angel of light. He took over the sanctuaries of the old sun gods of the pre-Christian religions. And at that moment in time, every year, the sun shines down this line, animates all these places, and the dragon energy in the earth starts to reawaken. And they used to have festivals with great fires and celebrations and things at this moment in time to honour and celebrate the life on earth. It must have been an absolutely extraordinary thing to have been involved in. Certainly, if you'd have stood on top of the hilltops at Beltane, you would have seen a great chain of fires being lit all the way down the line, which is, it's this as above, so below thing that was so strong in former times. What was happening on earth reflected what was happening in the heavens. So by lighting fires at these sacred hilltops, you were actually honouring that solar power that was coming back into the earth and awakening the dragon energy. And you pointed out about the Chinese tradition here. Of course, it was never Christianized. So the in Oriental countries, the dragon is still the most beneficent influence you can invoke. Great symbol of luck and health and virility and fertility and inspiration. And I think that it was universal in very ancient times, wherever you look. A lot of this information, you know, has been politicized by the Christian religion, no doubt about that.
This is a straight track, the Michael line, but I've also heard that dowsers working with this notice that the line changes, that we interact with the line and it responds to us, and it can go serpentine as well, that it's a living energy and it's not static. Do you want to explain that?
Absolutely. This is what we found, really, because when you start to follow these alignments or ley lines or whatever you want to call them, then when it comes down into the earth level, nothing in nature works in a straight line. Everything works in an organic fashion. So curving around this straight line, which is a conceptual thing on the landscape, are these dragon lines operating in polarity. Male lines, which when we started working with them, we call the male one Michael. It's handy to give these things names because it helps us to get a handle on it, really. They have different frequencies of vibration, which through dowsing you can differentiate. The male and the female lines curve through the landscape. In classic Chinese feng shui, as we're talking about China here, they have a long-standing tradition that goes back many, many thousands of years, which talks about the science of earth energies. If you look at those old documents, you'll discover that they refer to these two magnetic currents in the earth, one female, one male. And this is what happens with the living biosphere of the planet, it seems to me. The places where the male and the female energies cross are always located very significant spots. Glastonbury Tor, Avebury, all very old churches and sacred sites which were ritual centres. These are the points of creation which were recognised, I think, in antiquity.
On Glastonbury Tor, in your book, you point out that the Michael and Mary lines create an intersection, a dance in a sense, a labyrinth, the two, how they wrap around each other. And indeed, there's the old labyrinth that was made out of earthworks going around the Tor. So understand people processed up there in this spiraling fashion following this.
This is another very interesting aspect, I think, to some of these explorations, is that we've found that these dragon lines, as we call them, actually follow old pilgrim routes. This is an important concept because if you think back to the concept, the original idea of pilgrimage, which goes back many, many thousands of years to Paleolithic times, even before people settled down on the earth and they were moving continuously around the countryside according to the cycle of the seasons, they were actually totally connecting with that energy and walking along with the earth's energy from one sacred site to the other. And I think this is the root of the concept behind pilgrimage. It's a very important one, I believe, because it's not something to do with the ancient past. It's something to do with now. When people go to a sacred site, they're immersing themselves in this energy. A lot of people will have a particular place, if they're feeling a bit fed up or depressed or confused at a particular stage in life, they will have a place in the landscape that they go to and sit quietly. And they will sit there for a while, and they will come away, and they will be refreshed and nourished by the earth. And this is, I think, a very important dimension to this, because we're reconnecting with the earth, but there is a corresponding reaction from the earth when we do this. Because if you douse the energies, you'll discover that, for instance, if people are chanting in a church or a cave or a temple,
it gets stronger.
It gets stronger. All the energies magnify. The earth responds to our response. It is a continuous process. Energy does not stop and start. It just carries on. And I sense a lot of people are now waking up to this idea. People are beginning to feel this need to go back to these places. We have lost contact with the earth spirit, and maybe it's very, very important for the next phase of human evolution that we make that reconnection.
The ancients felt, I mean, so many indigenous societies did, that it was our job to help to balance this world and the next, to keep things activated. This was our assignment here.
I think you're probably right, yes, because we're talking about spiritual energies here. As we know, the whole earth is vibrating. Everything is vibrating and resonating. And the spiritual energies are the earth energies. They are the same thing. It's just a different level of resonance. So everything is completely interconnected. You know, the later religious idea that you can separate spiritual energies from other energies and say, for instance, that, you know, certain things are good and certain things are bad, I think is very much an overlay, and a certain level of ignorance is shown there in the understanding of the way the universe works. Everything is connected. Everything has energy fields around it. None of us are immune from that. Everything is alive. The Earth especially so. And I think, actually, it's calling to us again.
It's quite a dialogue we could be carrying on once again, too. Do you think that by laying out a labyrinth, by walking the labyrinth, it's now a very popular activity, that you're bringing up, welling up some of this Earth energy, or that you could ask it to go where you're conducting your rituals? Can you bring it? Is part of the reason that the labyrinth is at Glastonbury Tor, not only it's on the Michael line, but swirling because maybe people walk that labyrinth, and so then the lines started to, the energy lines started to align with that? Do you think it's a chicken and egg question, or simply that we must respond to where it is?
Energy's alive and moves and changes by the moment. It's never static. So although energy will flow in a natural way through a landscape, if you construct a motorway across it, you will interfere with that energy. Fast-moving traffic will fragment that energy and stop it flowing naturally. Again, buildings which are put in positions which are unsympathetically constructed out of materials which are deadening to this energy will create problems in this. I think maybe a lot of the problems that people have in the modern world is because this isn't taken into account. Old architects looked very, very carefully at sites before they put a building. And when they put the building there, they would construct it usually out of local materials, which was vibrating and resonating with the local landscape. This creates a very harmonious atmosphere to live or work in. Some of the old Cornish cottages that are in this area are good example of this, because when you walk into these old buildings, you immediately feel at home and relaxed, and you think, what a beautiful place to be in. How different that is to walk into an office block made out of concrete and steel, with the sick building syndromes and everything that people get, and they find lots of stress building up. And it's a lost art, actually, this. And again, I think we have to become very, very aware of the way we are affected by our environment in all its different diversity.
So the Chinese called it feng shui, and it's the science that they've kept alive continuously. We once knew it, we just forgot it. And now we're reviving this understanding of it.
Unfortunately, it seems the way of the world, the ways of the world sometimes are very strange, because there are stories in China now where if you're having problems in your house, you'll call the dragon man in, and he'll charge you like $1,000 or something, and you'll say, yes, you need a mirror up there on that door, and you've got to have a little tree there with a pool of water, and you'll be fine.
He prescribes the cures.
But what they'll often do is direct the energy next door and then go knock next door and, you know, and do.
You need my services.
So, well, exactly. So, I mean, you know, good business maybe will always override some of these principles. But I would suggest that that is a fairly recent phenomenon, and that in antiquity it was treated much more as a sacred science. And, of course, people knew more about it. So they didn't really need those experts to come in so much, because they felt it, because we all have these instincts and these spiritual sensibilities in our own natures.
We are the instrument to detect this energy.
People can feel it instinctively when they go to a place. You felt it here. I mean, outside this church is a grove of trees with a big dragon line coming in through those trees into the church. And you've just seen two amazing trees, which I call the dancing trees. They're very ancient oak trees, and they are writhing and dancing in this energy in the most extraordinary fashion.
And it affects the way that their limbs are positioned.
In the energy. Now, if human beings are allowed to immerse themselves in this energy as well, they grow in the same way. They start dancing with life. They become part of the flow. We've cut ourselves off from these flows, the flow of life.
I wonder if we did it, though, because look at Avebury, this extraordinary site, and somebody goes and plunks a village and crisscrossed roads right in it. You couldn't do a better thing to do a more effective way to deactivate it. Let me put it that way. And so was this intentional by some institution threatened by this energy?
It was intentional. We know that because there was a man called Stone Killer Robinson in the 18th century, I believe, who was basically paid by the church to go and break up the megaliths. And they used to make big pits next to the stones and topple the stones over and build fires under the stones and pour cold water on them to break them all up. And in fact, there's a little chapel built right in the centre of the Great Circle at Avebury, which is constructed entirely out of a stone, out of fragments of stone called the obelisk, which was about 40 feet high. It was the largest stone in the complex, and there's enough stone in that single stone to build a chapel, virtually. So it was a deliberate policy of the powers that be in those days to stop people going to these places to try and, you know, wean them away from that connection with the earth they had. And, of course, once you build a church on a sacred site, you have control of it. You know, it's up to you what happens in that church. You can lock it. You can keep people out. You can just let them in when you want to. Fonts in churches are often locked because they didn't want people to steal the holy water. It's all a sort of control mechanism thing. But if we can cast our minds back to how it once was, I think we will begin to glimpse a much more free and open attitude to these ideas. Celtic Christianity, which is basically Druidism, nature worship, in those days people had a direct contact with the divine. You could go to a sacred site. You can still do it. There's nothing to stop you. You can meditate amongst the trees. You can go to the sacred pools of water and the holy wells, and you will find you have the most amazing life-transforming experiences, spiritual-type experiences. It comes very, very easily. Doesn't cost any money. You don't have to know anything about it. You just sit there quietly. That's all you do. But, of course, when Christianity came in, you had to pay a priest to talk to God for you. So the whole emphasis shifted, and all of a sudden, you were abstracted from divinity. But the truth is, we're all walking around with the divine spark in us.
And we don't actually need a sacred site to make that connection. The sacred site just makes it a little easier or deeper.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're absolutely right. People who meditate can access these levels of consciousness quite readily. And wherever you are is the sacred site.
You're still sitting on Mother Earth.
You're still sitting on Mother Earth. You're still we are part of the Earth. We are born of the Earth. We are vibrating to the same frequency of the Earth. The Earth is vibrating about 8 hertz or so, 8 cycles a second, which is the brainwave patterns of the human brain when it's in alpha rhythm. So when people are in a meditative frame of mind, they are actually becoming consciously part of the Earth.
Tuning.
It's sort of a tuning, yeah, absolutely, a tuning to places. But the thing about these particular ancient sites is that the natural meditation that takes place is effortless. You don't actually have to do any work.
It comes out to meet you halfway.
It's there. As soon as you approach a sacred site in the right frame of mind, with honour and respect, the site itself responds. And I think a lot of these sites have spiritual guardians also, which are there, and they know how the sort of frame of mind that people are in when they're approaching. If there's no respect, you'll get no response. But if you ask and honour, then, you know, you will get response from these sites and you will have unforgettable experiences. It happens all the time. It's happening more and more, actually.
And so that's why people seek parts of nature to sit and do meditation, because at least there the energy lines haven't been disturbed as they would be if you had a city built over a sacred site.
Well, I mean, there's no question that that's true. Nature is everything. We can go against nature. But, you know, that will affect us in not necessarily a good way. But nature will always triumph in the end. There have been many, many civilizations on the planet Earth, and all of them have risen and all of them have fallen, and this one will do exactly the same. But the thing is, what's going to come after that? I think we need to look very, very closely at the way nature operates, because in nature, all the cosmic laws are written. And we are not above that. We are part of that. We need to remember that.
And a good place to start is The Dance of the Dragon, an Odyssey into Earth Energies and Ancient Religion. Paul, thank you so much for alerting us to the Earth energies and how the ancients used them. And this is a living tradition. This is a living biosphere, living energy. So what do you think's ahead for this? If the old religions have been cut off, they can be renewed. We just go to the source again.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, Laura. You know, it's we're at this critical stage of human history where anything can happen. Maybe our only salvation is to go through some leap of consciousness, some quantum leap of consciousness, where we become aware of these realities again, because we have been deprived of the knowledge. Certain people have always known about these things, but they've sort of rather kept it quiet to themselves, you know. But now I think it's time for everybody maybe to become aware of these things again and to start to go on the quest, their own grail quest, if you like. You know, it's an inner quest, but it takes place on the earth. So it's an inner and an outer quest. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of showing you some very interesting and powerful sites in the last few days in Cornwall. And I think you've been quite affected by some of them. And I sort of rest my case there, because very little more needs to be said, because you have had those experiences. Anybody can have those experiences. They're free. They're freely given. And yet you're never quite the same again. And that's got to be good.
And thanks for listening here today. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com.